manner that recognizes and respects Indigenous cultures and traditions.
Hello, and welcome back to Women's Health Interrupted Field Trip. I'm Dr. Marina Adshade.
And I'm Damara Featherstone. Our next stop on this field trip is Global Health and Public Policy, where we will meet Dr. Veena Sriram.
So buckle up and enjoy the ride.
So today we are joined with the incredible Dr. Veena Sriram. Dr. Sriram's research sits at the intersection of global health, social science, and public policy. And specifically, Dr. Sriram focuses on understanding power and politics in health policy processes in mainly low and middle income countries. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here with both of you.
What a pleasure. Looking at your research, I'm intrigued because, you know, in economics, we have our own ideas of what power is. Power essentially is the way that people resolve conflicts. I'm thinking that maybe you have a different approach. And so maybe we could start by that. You could talk about in your research, when you talk about power, what do you mean there?
That's a great question, because when we think about power, I think we're all actually coming from the same core place, but we define it a bit differently. We conceptualize it a bit differently. But I think ultimately you're right that it is about who is able to direct or influence the course of events. Now, I would differ a bit in it being only about conflicts. I think power can be something a little bit more diffuse, where, for example, say a group of people are getting together and trying to push through a policy objective that they might have. They may not win in that first instance, but there's something gained through the process of getting together and forming that network and building that capital that might actually make them more powerful in the long run. So I sort of see it as something a bit more of a process and something that's a bit diffuse, and where you're gathering different sources of power, and you could have short-term gains, you could have medium-term gains, you could have long-term gains. And it is something that's also, I think, quite rooted in history and context as well. So that's how I would think about power. Again, very loose and diffuse definition, but it encapsulates what you were referring to as well, Marina.
That's interesting. So in economics, this is what we refer to as social capital. And that's a great concept. Yeah, I think it's really interesting because I've actually never thought about social capital in the health context. So really informative.
Yeah. And a lot of your papers have argued that if we don't understand the role of power in healthcare relationships, that we're missing a really critical concept to transform health policy and health systems. How do you think that power can impact interactions in the healthcare system from that individual patient-doctor relationship all the way to the global scale?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I may take a step back and just think about why is power important for us to understand when it comes to health? And I think part of it is where a lot of our research on health sits, which is typically sort of in the biomedical realm, right? Where we're really looking for these interventions and solutions that are addressing a particular issue or a particular problem. And those are absolutely critical, hugely important. I think where sometimes as health researchers, we tend to get stuck is we get frustrated with, well, why isn't this intervention or why isn't the solution gaining more traction in the policy sphere? Why aren't decision makers latching onto this? Why aren't they providing more resources to this issue? We know it works. And I think that's where we really need to start taking a broader view about and really incorporating an analysis of power into our understanding of these situations. So, for example, when it comes to policy, who's in charge of decision making? Who is driving those decision makers? What is driving them? What are the pressures that they face in their roles? Where is the funding coming from? What are their objectives as funders? And then going back further into history, I think a lot about the role of colonialism and how it's impacted decision-making structures, particularly in low and middle-income countries. So I think that's where an understanding of power is really important. And then, of course, that's sort of upstream. Take that downstream, and then that goes directly into your question about how does power impact those interactions, even in facilities between providers and patients. One way that I'll illustrate this is from my experience in India. So I grew up in India. I grew up in a family of doctors. So I say this with tremendous sympathy and affection for the community of medical professionals as well, because I'm not a doctor myself, but I am part of it in the sense that through family, my parents are doctors, grandfather, uncles and aunts and so on. But the problem in India is that doctors are very often seen as godlike, right? People put so much trust and faith into their medical professionals. And medical professionals don't always, on the other side of it, recognize the power that they have in terms of how they're sort of directing the courses of people's lives through the interaction that they're having in a facility. And how all of that is shaped by things like gender, caste, religion, class, ethnicity, so many different factors. So it starts there with what kind of quality of care is being given to that patient in that interaction. What kind of trust is that building in the health system? And you can expand that in so many different directions from there. And that has so many impacts, for example, on health outcomes and the kinds of disparities we see amongst especially marginalized communities all over the world. This is certainly not just an India-specific problem.
Can I just follow up on that? Because I'm really interested in what you said about trust and about the intersection between power and trust. And I think that's a pretty obvious case where that could affect health outcomes, where if somebody doesn't trust the healthcare provider, the person who's giving them the instructions, go home, take these drugs, take these actions, change your lifestyle in this way, that could have a pretty big impact on the individuals. And if people who are marginalized are less trusting of the healthcare system, that could have a pretty significant impact on their health outcomes.
Oh, absolutely. Trust is also clearly now an upstream issue. We've gone through this now with COVID, where we really see that trust is one of the reasons that some countries have done better in the response versus others. But it is something that's very so amorphous, right? Like, how do you build trust in populations of millions and millions of people? But clearly, it's essential as something that needs to be kind of a core principle of health systems.
Yeah, wow. Just circling back to the last question, you touched on how you think research on power needs to be more embedded in the healthcare system. I'm wondering if you could let us know a little bit about how research on this and also action on power can promote more transparent and equitable and fair healthcare systems, in your opinion.
Yeah, and it's a great question. I would argue that I think anyone doing research on health has to engage with power, no matter what, especially if you're researching inequity, yeah? If you're researching inequities, disparities, you have to kind of put power at the center of that. I think for a long time, health researchers, we have tended to kind of see identity factors as variables. There's an excellent paper on this, again, in Health Affairs, where they talked about how seeing race, for example, as just a variable without really questioning and thinking about the role of racism in those inequities and in those disparities has really set us back in terms of addressing those challenges that we have with health inequity. Those are all questions of power at the end of the day in terms of who has power over decision making and why, and what that means for people's lives, for how long they live, for how healthy they are. No matter the kind of research we're doing, if it's in this realm of looking at inequity, I think we have to really wrestle with these questions of power in a more meaningful way. I think everyone implicitly knows it, but probably we have to make it explicit and sort of have those conversations openly so that we're actually kind of making more progress in these directions. Another thing I think that's really important, I try and do a lot of work at this sort of intersection of health and the social sciences. We really need to have more of that conversation between the pure public health side of it and the social sciences, because I think there's a lot that can be learned in having more conversations between these fields and disciplines.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In general, there's so little cross-disciplinary talk. So thank you for shedding some light on that.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's worth thinking a little bit about why that interdisciplinarity is important. I know we in the research community, we say that a lot, and I think we all agree. And it's the moving it to that next step about how do we do this meaningfully? I think that tends to be kind of the sticky issue. And my sense of it is that I think social sciences can really bring in that level of critical analysis into thinking about these health challenges in the health space. And so they can be very valuable if they're incorporated. It's just that our funding structures are not often designed in such a way to encourage that kind of interdisciplinarity.
I don't think it's very hard to imagine that individuals face a diversity of healthcare needs based on their socioeconomic status. So how much of those differences do you think are determined by power?
I think it ultimately almost entirely comes down to power in terms of what types of services one is able to access, the kind of socioeconomic factors that have shaped their childhood and all the way up to being an adult, how socioeconomic factors shape and influence their health, their social lives, and then ultimately that has effects that we see that carry on to their children. And so I think power really is at every step of that. How much power, and not just even in terms of how you can access services and the kind of treatment you receive, the quality of care that you're getting, the trust you have in the system. I think you can extend that argument also to kind of the power you have in shaping the politics of the place that you live in. For example, what's happening in the United States around reproductive rights, I think is a really good example of this, where you can clearly see how the politics of the moment have completely stripped away the entire sort of landscape of access to reproductive rights in half the country, at least. What kind of power do you have in voting? How accessible is voting to you? Can you vote? What kind of information are you given? Do the candidates represent your viewpoints? I think all of these things are also reflections of power and ultimately do impact the kind of services that you're going to be able to receive on the other side of it. So in short, I think power is impacting every level of this, from your interactions at a facility all the way to the decisions that are being taken in state capitals and in national capitals. Extend that even further. Think about what's happening with access to vaccinations, the situation we just had with COVID vaccines, and rich countries buying up more vaccines than poor countries. Those are also manifestations of power. So we kind of see it at global, national, subnational, and local levels.
I'm so fascinated that you have this macro approach, right? Looking at the institutions of the country, looking at the distribution of power within countries on the large scale and how that has these impacts. Like, for example, when you think about colonization, which is also an interest of mine, and how colonization has contributed to a very unequal distribution of power within countries. In terms of what you just said about the United States and the reproductive rights, and who really holds the power there to make those decisions, is it in the hands of the voters? Or does the system such that so much power is given to the courts that it doesn't even really matter that, you know, more than half the country is supportive of women's access to abortion rights? And so I think this is a really great example of what you mean here when you talk about power and who holds the power ultimately to make these decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. It's another manifestation of that short-term, long-term trajectory of these kinds of policy debates. The reproductive rights question has been, I think, decades in the making in terms of politics, and we're seeing the outcomes of it, of strategies that were being made so many years ago taking place now. Even what you mentioned about colonialism, you'll often hear this argument of, oh, well, colonialism, for example, this year is India's 75th year of independence from Britain. And you'll hear a lot of people say, it's been 75 years. We can't blame the British for everything. No doubt about it, absolutely. But we can, I think, take a critical lens to seeing how certain institutions in countries like India, why they exist in the ways that they do. Why are they so centralized? Or why don't we have more transparency? Why does it clearly benefit some segments of the population and not others? You can go take that back to colonialism. And unless I think we clearly engage with those questions and wrestle with them and have debates about them, we can't imagine a better future, because we're not dealing with the reasons for why we're in this situation that we're in. So that's why I think delving into topics like colonialism and politics are really important, because they give us the clarity of why we're in this moment. And the future of it's going to be hard, but at least we can hopefully come to an agreement about the sources of the problem.
Yeah, and of course, as Canadians, we don't need to go particularly far to see the long-reaching effects of colonization and how that's impacted institutions, the distribution of power, because there are so many health inequities in terms of the Indigenous population, even here in British Columbia.
Absolutely. That's something, as someone new to Canada, I'm developing more of an understanding of the impacts of settler colonialism and what that has meant for the Indigenous population here and for decision-making. And it's something I'm I'm learning a lot about as I'm spending more time here. And there are such clear linkages between the different types of colonialism. That's, there's settler colonialism, there's the type of colonialism that's happened in countries like India. And the core of it is so similar in that it's one community exercising this kind of absolute power over another. And the impacts of that are generational and something that we have to continue to engage with today.
So finally, what do you think are the main takeaways for your research that you wish that women's health researchers should incorporate into their research?
I would like to see more of a feminist intersectional approach to thinking about policy processes. I think right now the kind of work that we have on understanding health policy processes, we don't often take gender and intersectionality as sort of a core research question guiding why policy decisions are taken in the ways that they are. I think it's very important that we all follow the lead of researchers like Julia Smith at SFU and others, and a whole host of women who are women scientists in low and middle income countries who've been asking these questions for decades, are taking sort of a feminist approach to policy analysis. I think we should all learn from their experiences and apply a lot more of that into our own research, in understanding what is the role of gender and intersectionality in the kinds of policy choices that are made, and to really start to explicitly bring that piece of it out. I think the last thing I'd say is just to kind of build on that point that I mentioned about women scientists in low middle income countries having been doing this work for a long time. I think it would be great to see more connections being built between scientists in high income countries and scientists in low and middle income countries who are doing this work on intersectionality and gender. Because I think we all want to move in the same direction, but we need to kind of break down some of the silos a little bit more going forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing with us today. And we are really excited to see where your research leads you in the future and all the incredible work you're doing. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Sriram, for joining us on this journey, and to all of our listeners who've been along for the ride.
We would also like to thank the UBC Medicine Learning Network, the University of British Columbia, and everyone that has donated to the Women's Health Research Cluster for their support of this project.
If you want to help transform women's health on a global scale, donate to the Women's Health Research Cluster today at www.womenshealthresearch.ubc.ca.
And if you like the episode and want to hear more, be sure to subscribe on whichever platform you get your podcast to be notified when episodes drop every second Wednesday of the month.
And check out our show notes online to dig into some of the resources we talked about today.
Until next time, I'm Damara.
And I'm Marina. Thanks for joining us on this journey.
Enjoying UBC Medicine Learning Network presents on CITR? Check out the entire family of podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Audible. Join the conversation and our community on social media. Follow at UBC MedVid on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, TikTok, Facebook, and LinkedIn. That's UBC, MedVid.
Hello, and welcome back to Women's Health Interrupted Field Trip. I'm Dr. Marina Adshade.
And I'm Damara Featherstone. Our next stop on this field trip is sociocultural anthropology, where we will meet with Dr. Sari.
So buckle up and enjoy the ride.
Okay, hello everybody. Today we are joined with the lovely Dr. Sari. Dr. Sari is a sociocultural anthropologist interested in transnational sexualities, migration, asylum, waiting, and queer and critical race theory, with a specific focus on the Middle East and its diasporas. So welcome, Dr. Sari. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So most of your academic career, you have focused on LGBTQ plus refugees seeking asylum. As we know, migration status is a huge aspect of socioeconomic status, and it can influence health really drastically. So from your experience, how have you seen migration status impact the well-being, mental, and physical health of the refugees you've worked with?
I've been working with LGBTQ refugees since 2014. And when I think about this question, the first thing that comes to my mind is a sentence, which is, waiting has made us sick. So I have heard this sentence from almost all of my interlocutors. And this notion of becoming sick or getting sick refers to emotional anxiety that refugees experience because of long waiting times and the physical health issues that they develop during this period of waiting because of the material conditions of their lives, like harsh working conditions or not having access to proper healthcare. So I would like to talk a little bit about these things and explain how this notion of becoming sick is related to people's migration experiences and their socioeconomic status. So refugees I work with spent many years waiting in Turkey, which is a transit country. So they are waiting in Turkey to be able to come to Canada or go to United States or a few European countries. And during that time of waiting, they do not have work permits, but they have to pay for their own expenses and basic needs like housing, food, bills, and everything else that one needs to survive. So many refugees work informally. And this is the case with unauthorized informal migrant workers elsewhere. So LGBTQ refugees in Turkey also work under inhumane conditions, including heavy workloads, long working hours, and insecure working conditions. So I did my field work in a small town called Denizli in the southwest of Turkey. And most of my refugee interlocutors and friends in that city work in textile factories. So some of them also work in the service industry, like coffee shops and restaurants. And some of the gay men I know also work in construction jobs. So I have noticed that many people working in construction and manufacturing often develop musculoskeletal disorders due to demanding work conditions, like intense and repetitive bodily movements, standing for 10 hours a day or lifting and carrying really heavy stuff. And as part of my ethnographic research, I also worked in a small textile factory alongside with my interlocutors. My initial hope was to work there at least for a month, but after only a week, I had to quit the job because I could no longer tolerate the waist and the shoulder pain I had. And in that textile factory, I've also noticed that refugees work without protective equipment like masks and gloves, and they develop a lot of health problems ranging from eczema to asthma. Most of them suffer from lung problems because they keep breathing in cotton dust. And at the end of a week, I was really scared that the job would do some permanent damage to my health. So this short research in the textile factory gave me an embodied first-hand understanding of how difficult and how bodily harming refugees' work conditions are. And this short experience also shows us how socioeconomic status impacts people's well-being differently, because I was a citizen of Turkey and a researcher from a US university. So I had the luxury to choose whether I could work more or whether I should quit the job. But my refugee interlocutors didn't have the same option of prioritizing their health over their financial survival, because in order to survive, they have to continue working under these difficult, exploitative, and damaging work conditions. And this creates a lot of health problems. So this is what many refugees mean when they say waiting has made us sick. And the second component of this notion of becoming sick is the mental health issues. So as I mentioned, refugees wait for many years, and they wait without knowing when they would be resettled or which country would accept them. So there is a lot of uncertainty. And this unknowability of one's future is not an easy one to handle, because I think we all want to have some kind of stability in our lives, some kind of security. We want to feel that we have some power over our lives, that we can control our lives, that we can plan at least for our near future. But in refugees' cases, none of this is possible, because things change very quickly according to the larger political and economic issues. For instance, in 2017, when Donald Trump was elected as the president of the United States, he closed the borders from everyone from predominantly Muslim countries. And all of a sudden, refugee resettlement to US has stopped completely. So this kind of abrupt changes and uncertainties in the asylum system creates a lot of stress and anxiety in refugees' lives. And finally, on top of all of these, When they wait in Turkey, LGBTQ refugees are also constantly subject to discrimination, abuse, and different forms of violence by locals, by public authorities. For instance, they always fear that they might be evicted from their apartments if their landlords or if their neighbors find out that they are LGBTQ. They are afraid that they might be subject to physical violence on the streets because of their refugeeness or because of their non-normative genders and sexualities. They are afraid that the Turkish state might try to deport them at any moment by using a simple excuse. So a combination of these issues, the uncertainty of the future and the insecurity of the present, create a lot of emotional and mental health problems in refugees' lives. So many people suffer from anxiety and stress. And of course, people do their best to maintain their emotional well-being. They try to keep themselves busy with other things. They spend time with their friends, or they create mutual collective support mechanisms to cope with these feelings of exhaustion, boredom, insecurity, and uncertainty. And they try to maintain their hope for a better future. But it's not always easy to do so. And unfortunately, many people I know have experienced severe depression at different stages of their waiting. So when they say waiting has made us sick, I think they refer to this combination of dire material condition of being a refugee as well as the emotional violence of waiting.
So you talked about how being a refugee, waiting to find out where you're going to go, how that affects people's health. But I'm curious about how it affects people's access to healthcare.
Yeah, well, access to affordable and proper healthcare constitutes one of the most significant problems in refugees' daily lives. So currently, refugees in Turkey do not have access to free healthcare. They are not covered by the national health insurance. In 2019, the Turkish government has abruptly announced that refugees are not eligible for free health insurance after their first year. And so accordingly, Turkey provides healthcare coverage to refugees only for their first year. And after that first year, refugees are expected to pay for their medical expenses on their own. And as you can imagine, this is really difficult because refugees do not have work permits in Turkey and they don't have any reliable financial support either. So this is a question for all of us. How someone with no employment, no financial support, and no long-term legal status can afford to have access to healthcare? And the answer is most of the time they cannot. With this new regulation, the vast majority of refugees who have been in Turkey for, you know, more than 1 year are cut off from existing health services. And the only exception to this new regulation is the refugees with so-called special needs. And I'm saying so-called because what counts as special needs is arbitrarily decided by local asylum officers. So I interviewed a social worker in 2020, and she mentioned that usually children, elderly refugees, pregnant women, and refugees with disabilities are found eligible for health insurance. So these are the groups that are considered as people with special needs. But transgender refugees and refugees living with HIV/AIDS are not covered among the special needs, and they are denied access to health insurance. So then the question is, right, how come pregnancy or disability makes someone a person with a special need, but living with HIV positive doesn't? So how I approach this question is, I think this shows us that public authorities have an enormous discretionary power in deciding what counts as special need and who should be eligible for health insurance and who doesn't. And if we take this kind of questioning one step further and think more politically, this also shows us that the immigration authorities decide whose lives and whose health matter and whose lives and whose well-being are not deemed as important. And LGBTQ refugees are often at the very bottom of this hierarchy of differential evaluation of life and health. So this is the legal political perspective on the question of access, but there are also other problems that impact people's access to healthcare services. So among them, the most important one I've observed is the language barrier. So in some cases, hospitals and different NGOs provide translators and interpreters for refugees, but most of the time, refugees are really on their own. and they face language barriers in their encounters with healthcare providers, and it restricts their use of existing services. And finally, speaking of this question of access, I also want to mention a more intersectional approach. Refugees are excluded from healthcare because of their legal status, because they are refugees and they don't have health insurance, but also because LGBTQ refugees, they face additional challenges in hospitals, not only because of their refugeeness, but also because of the stigmatization of non-normative gender and sexuality. So I have found out that they are subject to homophobic and transphobic treatment. Sometimes they are called names by healthcare providers. Sometimes their problems are dismissed or not really taken seriously by the doctors. I have observed that trans and gender non-conforming refugees have particular problems. For instance, when their gender expression doesn't match the biological sex assignment on their ID cards, they are denied appointments. So each time they need to explain their gender and sexuality over and over again. And if you are a refugee with a kind of insecure legal status and limited language, it's not always easy to talk to strangers like doctors, nurses, or other healthcare providers about your gender and sexuality, because these are, for many people, intimate matters. And because of all of these restrictions and barriers, refugees experience significant challenges to their access to healthcare. And as you can imagine, this creates a lot of detrimental effects on their well-being.
Yeah, oh, so many layers. That ties to something you were chatting about a little bit earlier as well. And to do with the paper you were chatting about, the lesbian refugees in transit, the making of authenticity and legitimacy in Turkey, you speak about how, specifically in this paper, these women's sexualities are persistently questioned, disbelieved, and they are considered straight until proven otherwise by these organizations they're trying to seek asylum through. And I'm just wondering how you have seen these women work to navigate these transitional spaces, negotiating and leveraging the different parts of their identities in the process, because in the country they're fleeing from, they're fleeing because of their sexuality and gender identity. In the country they've arrived in Turkey, they can experience this discrimination even in the healthcare system, like you just said. But then to these organizations that they're trying to seek final asylum through, they need to prove their identity, which in society they've forced to hide it because it can be detrimental to their health and well-being. So how is this possible for people to prove these identities to these organizations when their entire life they've had to keep them secret for their own safety? How are the people you're working with navigating through that?
Yeah, exactly. In that article, I've written about how refugees in Turkey navigate different organizations at different scales, like local, national, international, and diasporic. So they follow up on their asylum claims, both with the Turkish state and other international asylum authorities, like the UNHCR and IOM, International Organization for Migration. They are also bounded by the immigration laws and regulations of the resettlement countries like the US and Canada. And they also work with a lot of NGOs, both from Turkey and abroad, when they need financial or legal assistance. And when my interlocutors navigate these different actors and different offices and organizations, they encounter different understandings of what is authentic, real queerness, and who is a proper lesbian or queer woman, and who should be eligible for these rights and resources. One of the main findings of this research, this paper, was that women and refugees in general quickly learn this complicated system, and they find out about different expectations and different requirements that these different organizations have. And then they strategically tailor their identities, their asylum narratives, and their bodily performances to these different expectations. Many women have to do this navigation on a daily basis. When they go to asylum authorities, they need to perform a highly visible queerness. And on the streets or in their workplaces, they need to hide that queerness and instead embody some kind of cisgender straight identity to protect themselves from possible discrimination and homophobic, transphobic violence. On the one hand, this kind of navigation shows us how creative, resourceful, and strong refugees are, right? This is really important to emphasize because refugees, especially women and LGBTQ refugees, are often seen as passive victims of larger structural forces like patriarchy or homophobia. But here we see how they also reclaim their identities, their narratives, their bodies and sexualities, and they do it in very strategic and creative ways. But when I say this, I also don't want to romanticize this navigation as resistance, because this kind of work is emotionally and physically difficult. Because in order to protect yourself, you need to perform something, and then in order to have access to rights and resources, you need to perform something else. And within this system, you are not really allowed to be your fully authentic self. And you need to keep performing different parts of your identity to be able to get out of Turkey and go to the resettlement countries, or to be eligible for healthcare or financial aid. And as I mentioned before, this creates a lot of insecurity and uncertainty, and it paves the way to a lot of mental health issues in refugees' lives.
So what do you think are the main takeaways from your research that you wish that women's health researchers would incorporate into their own work?
Well, I was thinking about the importance of socioeconomic status. I think we all should take into consideration how legal and socioeconomic status impact people's well-being and their access to healthcare. And I think by doing so, we have a chance to decentralize the citizen as a norm in health studies. When we study a certain subject, who is the main figure that we take as the center of our analysis? Thinking about this different legal and socioeconomic statuses has the potential to decentralize the citizen as the norm, and all other people like immigrants, refugees, asylum seekers, stateless people, or undocumented people as deviation from the norm. So I really would like to see this immigration and citizenship status incorporated into any health research, because it's a very important component that enormously affects people's health. And second, I would like to see more inclusive studies on women's health, which include trans, non-binary, and queer people as well. So as I mentioned, I have spent a lot of time in hospitals, in gynecologist offices, and most of the time I wasn't really with refugees who identify as women, but I was with people who self-identify as trans, queer, non-binary, and gender non-conforming. And I've seen how they face additional challenges in accessing health services. What I've learned through my own research, and something I would like to propose as an important takeaway from that research, is to move beyond the biological category of womanhood towards a more inclusive and intersectional understanding of gender and sexuality. Because I think health and well-being and healthcare systems are the sites where these different intersections of different identities and different systems of power really come together and become very visible. So it's a perfect site to understand the combinations, the intersections of legal status, socioeconomic status, and gender and sexuality come together, and what kinds of impacts they create on people's mental and physical well-being.
Thank you, Dr. Sari, for joining us on this journey, and to all of our listeners who've been along for the ride.
We would also like to thank the UBC Medicine Learning Network, the University of British Columbia, and everyone that has donated to the Women's Health Research Cluster for their support of this project.
If you want to help transform women's health on a global scale, donate to the Women's Health Research Cluster today at www.womenshealthresearch.ubc.ca.
And if you like the episode and want to hear more, be sure to subscribe on whichever platform you get your podcast to be notified when episodes drop every second Wednesday of the month.
And check out our show notes online to dig into some of the resources we talked about today.
Until next time, I'm Damara.
And I'm Marina. Thanks for joining us on this journey.
Enjoying UBC Medicine Learning Network podcasts? Then you'll love our YouTube channel. Watch our award-winning medical educational media today at youtube.com/UBCMedVid. That's youtube.com/UBCMedVid. This has been a presentation of the UBC Medicine Learning Network.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest.
Yo, this is the boy, Jacuzzi Lefler. You here with Crimes and Treasons Radio. Jazz Cartier, y'all know who it is. Golden Child, baby, let's get it.
What up? This is Machine Gun Kelly, and right now I am tuned in to Crimes and Treasons, goddammit.
Hey, yo, this is Isaiah Rashad.
Crimes and Treasons, this is your boy Just Blaze.
Yo, 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 what's good? It's Bodega Bams, a.k.a. Poppy, a.k.a. Young Don Francisco.
Hey, yo, it's Baby No Money.
What's good, y'all? It's your boy Terrell Safady.
Hey, what's up? It's Tion Kidd.
What up? This is Stango.
And this is your boy Waldo.
And you're listening to Crimes and Treasons Radio.
Yeah, bitch.
What's up? This is Peanut Butter Wolf. You're listening to Crimes and Treason Radio.
Hello, this is Blowfly.
Hey, this is Halo.
Hey, what's up? It's St. John. And you're not listening to Crimes and Treasons. It's lit.
Hey, I know who it is, man. It's your boy,
Sahada
Prince.
Yo, what up, though? This is Ill Tone from Blacktivity.
Yo, peace, family. It's your Guala Dizzy Rice.
Yo, this is Remy Wolf.
Hey!
Yo, what's poppin', man? It's I Am Soup.
It's Jay Worthy, a.k.a. P Worthy.
Hey, yo, you already know what time it is. It's your boy, ASAP Yams, a.k.a. Lamborghini, a.k.a. Lil Newport, a.k.a. motherfucking. I got too many motherfucking aliases, but you already know what time it is. Crime and treason in this motherfucker. Shout out to these motherfuckers, they putting it down with that real trill shit.
Yo, it's Camp Blow Out.
Crimes and treasons, that's what we believe in while we blowing the treason.
Crooks out.
Tune in to Vancouver's rap radio show every Tuesday, 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
If I fail again this time, but I might just stray out of line. I'm not trying to be a prophet, I'm just trying to speak my mind. Morning hours are drawing nearer, laying in my bed. It seems that I should take a walk to ease my weary head. Let me roll. Sip on joy, the purest drink. Move to make, thought to think. They can feel us from afar, avenues and boulevards. So you gonna chew? I will not equivocate. If that's so, let's celebrate. Shamefully, shame's claim on me. Led my life with infamy. But I don't call it, I don't solve it, I dissolve it famously. I've been so politely at the bottom. Pull a tight bootstrap, strap it on and drop them. I've been so politely at the bottom. Pull a tight bootstrap, strap it on and drop them. Feverish you, I will not drop it. Power, cowards never stop it. I am nurtured, you corrupted. I am erupting, don't interrupt it. Careful, I'm a minimum trap, trap, trap. First of the secondary class, class, class. You know I don't trust you, that's the catch, catch, catch. Don't you fucking touch me, I will gnash, gnash, gnash. Cause I am an old phenomenon. And I am an old phenomenon. Show that we believe. See the unforeseen. Sharp and connected. Get those ringside seats. When the scorched of the earth come back by sea. Sip on joy, the purest drink. Move to make, thought to think. They can feel us from afar. Avenues and boulevards.
back for another Richmond broadcast. It's nice out, but unfortunately, we got to announce two more musicians' passings. John Gosling from the Kinks at 75 and J. Robbie Robertson from the Band at age 80. Well, this is crazy. That means we got songs to play.